Welcome to the Business of Behavior podcast, hosted by Dr. Becca Tagg. We support clinicians who have been bitten by the entrepreneurial bug, looking to strengthen their practice to better serve their clients, employees, and themselves.
Hello, and welcome to the Business of Behavior podcast. I am your host, Dr. Becca Tagg, and today is session 57. Today, we're going to talk about school psychology, and there's a couple reasons for this. One is a personal reason, which is I started working with kids and families as a school psychologist, and two, I think that as we as BCBAs start working in more settings, we are required to engage in more interprofessional practice. And when we have a better understanding of the training and experience and perspective of the professionals that we're working with or collaborating with, I think that that can really help strengthen our interprofessional practice that then results in greater outcomes for the kids and families and systems that we work with. So, as I mentioned, I started as a school psychologist after I finished undergrad at University of North Carolina, Wilmington in psychology. I was trying to decide what and where I wanted to go for graduate school. And I knew I wanted to work with kids and families. And my mom suggested school psychology because for a few reasons. One, they're written into the law, so there's a bit more job security than clinical psych. And also because I attended a therapeutic boarding school or residential treatment facility when I was in high school. And it was not a good place. I was in upstate New York, and it actually was shut down for child abuse years after I left. And so it was also couched as a school, as a private school. So kids spend a ton of time in school. And so I thought that it would be a really great place to affect change because kids were there. So you had a captive audience. And I also thought that if I got involved in this field, that I could help to prevent things happening like what I experienced at my therapeutic boarding school. To better understand school psychology, I think we want to understand a couple things. One is that school psychologists are written into the law. They must be involved in certain activities that occur at the education setting. And also that school psychology is one of the three veins of psychology that the APA or American Psychological Association recognizes and therefore accredits doctoral programs. So those three fields are counseling psych, school psych, and clinical psych. So if you're interested in a school psychology program, and it's a doctoral program, you want to be sure that it is accredited by the APA. For other programs, both, I guess, doctoral, but also master's programs or specialist programs, they're called for school psychology. APA does not accredit master's programs. So for school psych, you really want to be sure that the program is accredited or acknowledged by NASP. And NASP stands for the National Association for School Psychologists. So I mentioned that being a school psychologist, you have two options. There's either a specialist level or a doctoral level, and it includes graduate work, like formal didactic coursework. It's usually 3 years of full-time study, past the bachelor's degree, at least 60 credit hours, right? Or I guess if they do quarter hours, which some do, that's 90, and that's at the specialist level. One of those years of full-time study is an internship, and it's a full academic year that consists of at least 1,200 clock hours of supervised practice, and 600 of those must be in the school setting. And then within that coursework and experiences, the National Association of School Psychologists, again, or NASP, will indicate there's a certain number of different tests you have to give or different activities you have to engage in to ensure that it is you are meeting those minimum requirements, kind of in the same way that the BACB indicates restricted and unrestricted activities and then gives guidelines using the task list. NASP has something similar. At the time of this podcast, there are 240 universities that offer school psychology graduate programs across the U.S., and there are differences about where they're housed, right? So like some school psych programs may be housed under a university's School of Education, and some may be housed under the Department of Psychology. And so those different housing locations can affect the different flavors or nuances of that program. So if you want to work, so kind of some can prepare you more to be a practitioner, some may prepare you more to be a professor or a researcher. So again, really taking that time to look at what is the best fit program for what you want to do. I have a link in the show notes to NASP, which is nasponline.org. So you can go and kind of take a look at sort of the different options there. In addition to that coursework and the full year internship, those 1,200 hours, you also need to be certified or licensed by the state that you work in. And so if you're going to work in the public school setting, it generally is each state's Department of Education will grant you a license or a certificate. And there is an exam that you take for that, that is the Praxis exam in school psychology. And then in order to be a NCSP, nationally certified school psychologist, you need to earn a certain cutoff score on that Praxis exam and then maintain certain ongoing CEs that permits you to use that certification. So you can be certified in your state and not have national certification. So it's sort of about what's most important or what's important to you. For me, I do maintain my NCSP, that nationally certified school psychologist, for a few reasons. One is that I've moved a lot, and so sometimes having the NCSP makes it easier to have certification or licensure mobility, like to move from state to state. I think also because as I've accrued other education and certifications and licensure, I want to be sure that I'm always staying on top of what's happening in the school psych world. And so that NCSP requires that I keep up to date with what's happening in that domain. Again, that's important because I work with kids and families primarily. And so a lot of times, even as a clinical psychologist, I am helping families navigate the school system, or if I'm doing psychological testing, I want to be clear on what the Department of Education in each state is saying so that I can be sure that the evaluations I'm doing are going to help the child be served best in different settings. So if I know, so in North Carolina, it's DPI, North Carolina's Department of Public Instruction. If I know that they're going to require the Vineland as a specific adaptive behavior measure, then when I'm doing a private evaluation for a family as a clinical psychologist for a diagnosis, I can be sure to select, if appropriate, of course, the Vineland as an adaptive behavior measure instead of the ABAS or one of the others. The school psychologist there's different orientations. So there's the scientist practitioner, scientist practitioner scholar, right? And so a lot of these are, they mirror what some of the other psychology fields do. So like in clinical psychology, if you pick a doctoral program, you're likely going to pick either a scientist practitioner or scientist practitioner scholar. There's different types of training. And again, that's going to help you identify a program that's going to be the best fit for you and your career goals. So if you're in graduate school for school psychology and you really want to work in an academic setting, then it's going to be really important for you to have certain types of training experiences. School psychologists' role is ever-changing. I guess that's probably true of many people, right? But for school psychologists, your role can vary depending on what type of setting and where you're working. So for example, when I worked for one public school setting, I was serving 5 schools, and in another place, I served 2 schools. So it really depends on the number of kids that you're serving, how big the schools are, what type of work you're doing. So for example, it used to be that there was more of a test and place sort of format or job description, where really school psychologists came in after the student support team or child study team, whatever the district called it, had done, had met with parents and designed an evaluation to determine if the child meets eligibility as a student with a disability based on the IDEA categories. And that probably sounds like a really big mouthful, and I intentionally say it that way because school psychologists do not diagnose. School psychologists participate in the eligibility classification, so determining whether a child meets eligibility to be identified as a student with a disability as outlined by IDEA's categories. And this is different than when I work as a clinical psychologist. I'm really looking at the entire DSM to determine what, if any, diagnosis is appropriate for that child. And school districts do not diagnose. They offer classifications based on IDEA, or that Individuals with Disabilities Education Act classification. And it's really focused on if there is a disabling condition that means that the student is not being successful in that educational setting and requires specially designed instruction. So school psychologists have training, lots of training in testing and assessment, which I really enjoy. So IQ tests that are really often called cognitive assessments, achievement tests, right? So to identify whether there's an intellectual impairment or a specific learning disability. School psychologists can also assist in identification of social-emotional disabilities or behavior-emotional disabilities. So they may administer some, in addition to the cognitive tests or those IQ tests, academic achievement testing, and then adaptive behavior rating scales like the Vineland or the ABAS. And those are really, adaptive behaviors are how independently successful an individual is in their day-to-day tasks. It's not their best day. It's not their worst day. It's their average. And that's looking at identifying how much support an individual may need in order to complete the tasks of daily living. School psychologists may also be a part of behavior rating scales above and beyond those adaptive behavior measures. So things like the BASC, the Behavior Assessment System for Children. I always think of that as like casting out this wide net and kind of seeing what comes up that you can assess further. It looks at internalizing behaviors. So kind of, I always describe those to parents as when a individual turns their stress inward on themselves, right? So it can be anxiety, depression, somatization, which is when you experience your stress as physical illness. So saying I have a headache, and you do have a headache, and it's also related to kind of psychic or psychological distress, or externalizing behaviors, which is often those behaviors of taking your stress and turning it outwardly. So that can be conduct problems, hyperactivity, inattention. And so school psychologists, as part of the testing piece of what they do, engage in testing with the kiddo and pull that information together into a picture, a comprehensive picture of how that child performs in the school setting, and then brings that information to the IEP team and shares that information. And that information is taken in along with the information by teachers or related service providers like speech language pathologists, occupational therapists, physical therapists. And then together, the IEP team determines what is the best or most accurate IDEA category for that student's profile of skills, weaknesses, strengths, deficits. And then based on that information, an IEP is developed. School psychologists, so again, lots of training in testing and assessment across different domains. So cognitive, academic, which is sometimes called achievement, and behavior. I think it's also important to know that school psychologists have training in behavior analysis, and that's going to depend on what school you attended as far as how much training you get in that area. You know, I attended Penn State and also Indiana University of Pennsylvania, and both of those are very behavior analytic oriented programs. And so I got a ton of training in behavior analysis. Of course, it's not 2 years full time just on behavior analysis. And I got a lot of training in writing or conducting and writing FBAs and behavior intervention plans. And so I think that we want to be careful and thoughtful that just because an individual is not a BCBA does not mean they don't have any training in behavior analysis. Sometimes what I see online is people say, well, so-and-so shouldn't be conducting an FBA. And I want to gently challenge that. For example, I was a school psychologist first, and I completed the ABA coursework 2 years before I ever sat for the exam because I didn't really need the certification. What I wanted was the knowledge. And so I think, again, we want to be really thoughtful about making sure that we are not under-assuming competence just because a person doesn't have that credential. Doesn't mean that all school psychologists do have the knowledge, and it doesn't mean that none have the knowledge. So I think that a way that we can help strengthen our interprofessional practice is to be thoughtful that other people's training may not be the same as ours, and that doesn't necessarily mean it's less than ours or not adequate at all. So I think I, my own personal example is I did have a good chunk of coursework in applied behavior analysis. Again, not as in-depth as the coursework that I received to become a BCBA. And I did have some good training as a behavior analyst or in applied behavior analysis. There also is some training in school systems. So school systems are their own animal. I know Matt Sikoria talks about this frequently in his Behavior Observations podcast, and I've talked about it in previous episodes about consultation in schools. And really, if we think about it from a behavior analytic framework, we never want to just jump into a system and start making recommendations when we don't have a thorough understanding of how that system works and all of the contingencies at play in that system. And schools are different than clinics or in-home ABA. And so it's really important that when we are working with school personnel, that we have an understanding about IDEA, right? So the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act, what that means, what that looks like. Because within that law are different rules and regulations and contingencies that affect what a school can and can't do and what they must and must not do. The ADA, or the Americans with Disabilities Act, is another important piece of information that we should understand. Some kids have an IEP, but some may have a 504, and that 504 refers to the Section 504 of the Americans with Disabilities Act, and so we need to understand that. I think understanding also the specific culture of each school, each classroom, each district that you consult in is also important. So we want to come in and observe that first before making recommendations. And school psychologists often go from school to school. So in this interesting way, you're a member of the school district, but you're always kind of a them instead of a us in the different schools because you're often assigned to multiple schools. So they can be a great resource as far as kind of asking, how does this school work? How does this classroom work? Because they have likely spent some time observing it as well. School psychologists get, so again, training in kind of school systems, some good training in teaching pedagogy. So really how to give good instruction. And some in counseling, some in consultation. So again, all of these different courses or content areas is going to depend somewhat on the different school that you attend. So some schools may emphasize statistics, right? Schools as in the school psych programs may emphasize statistics if they're really training those who are going to go into academics, whereas others may have, you know, two or three courses on statistics but not emphasize it. Or some programs may emphasize consultation more, and you may have more courses related to consultation as part of how that school psych program is set up. So again, all of the programs are a little bit different. They're all going to have a certain skeleton, right, that NASP outlines, and then they're going to fill that up or flesh that out with what builds their course sequences to best fit the goals for students matriculating through that specific school psychology program. Other parts of being a school psychologist is those, you know, 3 years of full-time study, independent field work, that's ABA, right? Your internship where you work full-time for a school district, which I also want to note, those are not always paid. And when they're paid, they're at a very small amount. So anywhere from $0 to $12,000 for the year. So I think that's important too, to make the distinction, because sometimes for BCBAs, we're very often paid for our supervised independent field work, and that's not the case always. So knowing that school psychologists really, and many others too, you know, kind of pay your dues, that's working essentially for free for that year is part of the process. And we kind of accept that when you're signing up to go through that program. There's also practicum. So each semester, I think mine changed each semester. We worked in a different school or a different district in a different capacity based on where we were in our studies. So I think my first semester, I just observed in classrooms, and I needed to observe a variety of different types of special education classrooms, from a resource setting to something that's maybe more separate setting, versus an ABA classroom versus a, you know, severe, they're often called, well, I guess not anymore, but a moderate classroom, a classroom for individuals with moderate disabilities, or adapted PE, or just really getting a picture of what all these different school settings and classrooms might look like to, again, be better able to understand and participate in those IEP discussions about placement. And then the more experience you get, so then I think year two, we worked in our university's clinic. So it was so anxiety provoking learning to administer these tests, right? You don't just read a book and do it. You read the manual cover to cover, and then you practice administering it with kind of every child that you know. And then you do it in classroom and get feedback, critique, both positive and constructive, from your professor and those around you. And then once you demonstrate competency, then you start to work in your university's clinic, where local students who need evaluations would come in, and either at a low or no cost would get an evaluation by the advanced standing graduate students. So I remember I am interested in kind of preschool aged kids. And so we had some little guys that were coming in, and so needing to learn a variety of different assessments fairly quickly based on what that referral question was, and that was sort of stressful. And when you administer them in the clinic, it's either through a one-way glass or the one-way mirror. So my professor could watch me on the other end, or he would be watching me through a video, and then I would again get graded on that and learn as many tests as we possibly can within reason. Sometimes it feels like it's not within reason because there's so much that needs done, and it's really strong training. You got to learn how to test and assess. And the assessments that we use are standardized, so they have to be administered in the exact same way each time, and they yield either standard scores or T scores, which is sometimes different than behavior analytic assessments that are often ipsative, right? So you're measuring the child against themselves, whereas in a lot of the assessments that school psychologists use, we're measuring them against other kids their age in the standardization sample. So it's really a normative assessment. And so it's comparing this six-year-old against other six-year-olds. And so it can give some valuable information there. I really enjoy working as a school psychologist. I think for me, what wasn't as great of a fit was I struggled with some of the extra stuff that comes along with working in a larger setting like that, or a larger institution. I really like working with kids, and I was finding that I was spending most of my time sitting in IEP meetings and less time working with kids, or that I would do an evaluation and be really stoked about the information that I learned, only to then come off the case, right? So it was test in place. And once the student was placed, I very rarely had anything to do with that child. So the intervention piece was passed along to a special education teacher or a school counselor potentially, or another individual. And that was kind of hard. I felt like I was starting a lot of things, but I didn't get to see the growth in the child because maybe I wouldn't see them again for 3 years for their next triennial, right? Which would be the next time that they would have a full evaluation. And I also felt like I was just testing and then writing up reports and then sitting in meetings and then testing and then writing up reports and then sitting in meetings. And it wasn't feeling as great. And then school districts started moving to what's called RTI, or Response to Intervention. It's also called MTSS, Multi-Tiered Systems of Support, or PSM, Problem Solving Model. It really is a different way of identifying certain disabilities. I could probably do a whole podcast on that, so maybe I'll make a note. But it moved towards where instead of just doing these standardized assessments to determine special education eligibility, for some classification categories like SLD, so specific learning disability, and then for some behavior areas, so social emotional areas, there is this process of response to intervention. So instead of just administering a test, and like for learning disabilities, if there's a 15-point spread between the IQ and the achievement, we would say it's a learning disability. And then it moved into this RTI model, which I'm going to use the language of RTI, although there are other, like I said, the MTSS and other sort of names for it, where you identify a learner who is not performing at grade level in reading, writing, math, and not just reading or math, but the specific sub-skills. So math calculation or problem solving or reading comprehension or oral reading fluency, right? So we're looking at these specific areas. And then instead of saying they're struggling, we implement an evidence-based intervention and progress monitor. And so the idea is that if we intervene at a higher level with more intensity and the child closes that gap between him and her peers, then potentially it's not a disability, but maybe just an area where they needed some additional support. But let's say we intervene and the child doesn't make progress, right? So we're doing this evidence-based intervention. The child's not making progress. We say, okay, where the data is not trending in the direction, or the rate of improvement isn't as steep as we would need to see in order for that child to close the gap between his or her peers. So then we're going to make a change, right? So we do a phase change line, we change the intervention again to another evidence-based intervention, and then we continue to progress monitor. And so let's say the child continues to not make progress or not trend in the direction we need to see or with the rate of improvement we need to see, so we make another change. And so anywhere from 2 to 4 changes in intervention based on the criteria for each state or that district as they interpret the implementation of RTI. Then if the child has had multiple evidence-based interventions implemented with fidelity and the child's performance is not indicating that it's closing the gap between his or her same age peers, then they look at saying this is a learning disability, or this is, you know, a social emotional disability. And so those are two different ways of identifying certain special education criteria or eligibility categories. And so when RTI started to become more popular, I thought, oh, this will be great because I'll get to be involved more in actually working with the kids. And in the beginning, it was that way. And then, of course, as the number of kids that are in this sort of process gets greater, then we need more sort of paraprofessionals or special educators that can deliver those interventions. So then school psychologists in many ways became more of data managers. So really tracking the data, being sure that there was data, making sure that the interventions selected were evidence-based. Intervention Central is a great website that you can go and kind of check out some of those academic interventions that have an evidence base to support them. So for academics and also for behavior. So the same thing would be true as you would implement some behavioral interventions. If the behavior improved, great. If not, then you're making some more changes. It's important to know that RTI is not for all eligibility categories. So some of those low incidence categories, so autism, for example, and in most cases, an intellectual disability, those still require administration of a standardized assessment to meet the criteria of IDEA and also this individual departments of instruction or education departments in each state. If you're interested in learning about what that looks like or what the testing requirements, what the scoring requirements, all of those are, you can see those on your state's Department of Education for their special education classification definitions. You can also see some of that on the IDEA website, or I'm looking at the website. So you can go to IDEA and kind of look at those different definitions. So again, I hope that this information is helpful in getting a better understanding about school psychologists and their training, their roles and responsibilities, and hopefully that can help all of us strengthen our interprofessional practice. Because with kids, they don't exist in a vacuum, and they don't exist in just one setting. They're members of their family system, members of the school as a whole, the school classroom, members of their friend groups, members of their extended family, members of the extracurricular activities they engage in. And so when we are working with families, I think the stronger understanding that we have of all of those systems helps us to best understand all of the different contingencies that are at play, that helps us to make the best recommendations and interact as successfully as possible with the other professionals that are also involved in helping to support the family. So as always, time is one of our most valuable resources, and I appreciate those of you who today and any other day have chosen to spend your time with me, Dr. Becca Tagg, on the Business of Behavior podcast. Have a great rest of your day.